Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. We're going to spend time this morning talking about amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, and a call for creating an ALS registry in Vermont. We'll hear about Governor Phil Scott's plans on how ARPA funds should be used in particular for housing needs in the state. We'll also hear from one of our WDEV All-Stars, Brent Curtis, and get a preview on what's coming up in high school basketball this week. And then we'll head to the Kingdom to hear about the first microbrewery in Essex County, Dirt Church Brewing. But let's start by learning more about a neurological disorder that many of us know as Lou Gehrig's disease, as the subject of the book Tuesdays with Maury, and as the recipient of funds raised through the Ice Bucket Challenge. It is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS. Joining me now is Karen Hammer Williamson, the Vermont Care Services Coordinator for the ALS Association Northern New England Chapter. Karen, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks so much, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you have a question about ALS or would like to talk about the need for a registry, an ALS registry in Vermont, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. How did I do on the pronunciation of ALS?
You did a great job, Rick.
All right.
It's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful, and hence why we call it ALS. But, Karen, tell us, what exactly is ALS?
So, Rick, ALS is also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, the baseball player whose struggle was portrayed in the movie. It's an always fatal neurodegenerative disease, and a person's brain loses connection with the muscles. And people with ALS have difficulties walking, talking, eating, and breathing. And those progress over time. It usually strikes people between ages 40 and 70, but it can happen at any time. And there's no known cure and limited treatment options at this time. So the life expectancy after diagnosis averages 2 to 5 years. So it's a very difficult disease to bear.
Karen,
there are many ways that it can begin and progress, but those are the basics.
Yeah, do we know what causes ALS?
We don't definitively know the cause. We know that the neurodegenerative process affects the voluntary muscles, and it was surprising to me when our friend Dan got ALS many, many years ago, that breathing is a voluntary neuromuscular function. I would think that that would be on autopilot, but right. I guess it makes sense when you think about sometimes people hold their breath when they're stressed out and have to be reminded to breathe. Right. So we don't have a definitive cause yet. We have learned 16 times the genetic information since the Ice Bucket Challenge that you mentioned. Right. The pace of research is really picking up. Genetics are important because 1 in 10 cases are familial, inherited. And the other 90% are sporadic. So we know that genes can be affected in how the body regulates the neuromuscular communication in the body. So all genetic information is a step forward in the fight.
So very little known about what causes it. There is no cure for it. And once someone is diagnosed with ALS, only about 2 to 5 years typically to live. And what we do know, though, and this is going to be difficult to listen to, but we do know what a person goes through, how it progresses. So can you explain what happens to a person's body once they contract ALS?
Well, that's an interesting question because it happens in different ways. Different subtypes are being identified. there's limb onset, and it really kind of depends which limbs are affected first. Some people's first symptom is shoulder pain. Some people have difficulty with fine motor in their hands. Some people have a foot drop, which can be a marked sign of ALS. And how it progresses and how quickly varies. While that 2 to 5 years is an average, mm-hmm. I've worked with people who survived a year or so after diagnosis, and the longest 14 years so far in my experience. There are people who've lived even longer. So that's rare, but it does happen. Other people with the bulbar form, their first signs may have to do more with breathing or swallowing or their neck strength. So I can't just say there's one progression. It really depends on the person.
Yeah, I see. Once someone is diagnosed and as it progresses, what can caregivers, what can family do at that point?
The most important thing to do once you get a diagnosis for ALS is get to an ALS multidisciplinary clinic. We know that multidisciplinary care extends life and helps people have the highest possible quality of life while they live with this condition. At an ALS clinic, there will be a neurologist who specializes in ALS. There will be a registered nurse, physical and occupational therapists with experience in ALS, respiratory therapy, social work, a dietitian, Dr. Tandon, who is a proponent of the registry that you mentioned, has been doing work on the area of nutrition and weight in ALS. And maintaining weight is associated with longer life and maintaining function and preventing harms like falls. And so we really emphasize maintaining weight. As you can imagine, if people are struggling, beginning to have difficulty with breathing or swallowing, maintaining your weight can be difficult. So there's lots of support for that. There's also palliative care to help people with fears and questions they may have about the dying process or about symptom management so that they can focus on living fully. After getting referred to an ALS multidisciplinary clinic, we hope that folks will reach out to the ALS Association. We have a newly diagnosed workshop for individuals and their family member where the focus is really on living fully with ALS because people are living while they combat this disease. And we want to celebrate and value their lives and support them in all of their meaningful activities as much as possible. We have a lab for caregivers. We have support groups, education material. We have great information for parents and school guidance counselors and pediatricians on how to talk with children and youth about ALS if it's a parent or a beloved relative who has ALS. And we have a durable medical equipment program and so much more. We have information about how to apply for disability income and Medicare if you're still working, and lots of webinars and ways to support you. So we hope folks will reach out.
Karen, what are annual medical costs for someone with ALS?
The number is pretty staggering. It's gone up recently. The total cost for ALS is estimated at $250,000 a year. And again, that's calculated over average lifetimes. It can be different for different people depending on the treatment they need. And that's counting all costs, lost work, disability, income, the value of family caregiving. Since COVID, family caregivers have really been stepping up. Our home helps have been stretched, but doing everything they can. But much more has fallen on the shoulders of family caregivers and close friends who are a person with ALS's first line of defense.
Karen, what are the goals that ALS Association has set?
We have a really ambitious vision. Thanks for asking, Rick. And of course, that starts with a world without ALS. And then after that, our goal is to advocate for, support research, and empower people with ALS so that they can live fully. We're really focused on that and have set a further goal to make ALS a livable disease by the year 2030.
Now, I want to talk about a registry and biorepository. So there is a national registry. What does the national registry do?
The national registry is so important, Rick. It is a voluntary registry. It's a series of questionnaires that someone can create an account if they have ALS and answer a series of questionnaires. Those questions are set by national researchers. It is confidential. Their identity is never released. And then they have the option to further donate samples of hair, blood, skin, and fingernail clippings. And the biorepository staff will send qualified people to collect that in the comfort of one's own home. And that registry information is available to all qualified researchers to use, again, without people's identity, so that they can look for common factors and aid in other research in the fight against ALS.
And when were the National Registry and Biorepository established?
I believe it was 2008, mm-hmm. Yes, and Massachusetts Registry was in 2003.
So, Karen, with a national registry, why would we need one here in Vermont?
Well, I think the frustration that Dr. Tandon and Dr. Elijah Stommel from Dartmouth-Hitchcock have expressed is that there have been questions in there and other researchers' minds about Vermont, and they can't get questions readily added to the national registry, and they can't get Vermont-specific data out of the registry. So that in terms of trying to look at things that are reported here in Vermont and at their research questions here, they can't get that information. Further, they're concerned that where the registry is voluntary, it looks like about 1 in 5 people don't register. I work as an outreach agent for the registry. That's part of our mission is to encourage. But we lose about 1 in 5 cases, they believe. And we, without access to seeing who's registering and who's not, nobody can hone in on the people who are left. I can't even ask someone directly if they've registered on the registry. I have to just say, if you ever need any help with your registry. And I think some people, they get confused about whether the clinical trial they're in is reporting their information. I always try to educate people, no, you have to actually go create your own account. The other further issue that's very concerning is that we suspect that a portion of those people who don't register are people who aren't getting to an ALS clinic in the best possible care. And we want to make sure, you know, some people hear this diagnosis and they don't realize there are things that can help you live as well as possible while you have this condition. We're concerned that there are some people who are going without optimal care, and that would be tragic.
Let's take a call. Judy's joining us from Barrie. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning. Is there genetic testing for ALS? And also, I know of a group of people over in the St. Johnsbury area that have been working really hard because it seems to be hereditary in their family. And they believe it all began back when Joseph Smith went out to Utah and proliferated wives, and then it spread from there.
Judy, thanks, Judy. Genetic testing, Karen, what can you tell us about that?
Sure. So genetic testing used to be emphasized in suspected familial cases, but now because we understand that genes regulate the neuromuscular system throughout life, most people with ALS choose to get genetic testing. Again, that's a choice. Nobody is ever forced to have testing. It used to be available to Vermonters just through going down to Mass General, but it's now available up at UVM locally and at Dartmouth as well. So we do encourage it. I hadn't heard about the Utah hypothesis. I would note that ALS is experienced worldwide. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure about, you know, what originates a genetic difference in familial for each family, but I am aware that ALS is a condition that people around the world experience.
Okay.
So the ALS Association actually is providing leadership with an international alliance of ALS and motor neuron disease organizations. We've been coordinating big data efforts to analyze data, common factors, risk factors around the world.
All right. And we should note Joseph Smith was a native Vermonter from the Royalton mm-hmm. area before heading first to New York State and then on to Utah. Let's get back to the registry, Karen. What exactly would the Vermont ALS Registry do?
So the Vermont ALS Registry would require physicians and providers who treat people with ALS to register their information with the Vermont Department of Health, which would maintain data and then make it available for research on a confidential basis to qualified researchers.
And this is what Vermont S-90, the Senate bill, would do?
Yes, and there would also be a quality control program along with it to assure that it's effective and that the data is maintained properly.
What would the cost be to the state to have this registry?
I heard yesterday in the bill doesn't specify it, or specify a potential appropriation amount. The Vermont Department of Health has submitted an estimate of $100,000 a year to the Senate committee. I imagine that would go through if it wasn't internally done, if it was contracted, you know, it would be subject to bidding. But that was their best estimate to the Senate committee yesterday.
Mm-hmm. And why does the ALS Association think a state registry, there's one already in Massachusetts, but a state registry is important?
Well, we think, you know, we value what the work that Dr. Stommel and Dr. Tandon have done for ALS in Vermont and New Hampshire. There's also a call for a registry in Maine. We were founded by people with ALS and their families, and they are very concerned about patterns of risk. We know that when military families asked the government to look into military incidents of ALS, it was found that military service is associated with twice the likelihood of getting ALS. There have been questions in Vermont about different environmental factors, farming exposures, lake factors, cyanobacteria, which the Department of Health tracks in the lake and publishes. And families feel strongly that they want to know as many answers as possible that are Vermont-specific.
Now, you mentioned that Massachusetts has had an ALS registry since about 2003. So are there elements from what they're doing there that would be used in Vermont's setup if approved by the State House, by the legislature?
Yes, they're very glad to collaborate and share their experience so that Vermont can benefit. In terms of specifics, that kind of goes beyond my technical background as a social worker, but they're very glad to share their experience as a state registry. And their cost is about $290,000, and they're obviously a much larger state, so they may well have some economies to share with Vermont.
Karen, we have about a minute and a half left, but I would like to double back for you to explain what the ALS Association does for those who have ALS.
So we're really a place that first of all, we're the largest private funder of ALS research in the world. That's the centerpiece of our fight. We also want to make sure that people with ALS have a chance to come together and also to make the connections that get them to optimal treatment. Here in Vermont, as part of the Northern New England chapter, we've been able to establish a quality of life grant that people can apply for to help with home modification, respite costs, or equipment they need, things that insurance won't pay for but are medically necessary. We have a equipment loan closet, a system of support groups, a caregiver learning lab, an annual symposium, but most importantly, a way to come together. This week, we're also advocating in Washington to get the Act for ALS federal legislation that passed in December its funding for this year. And that the goal of that legislation is to accelerate access to critical treatments and resources.
And Karen, how can people learn more about the ALS Association?
You can visit ALS.org on the internet. You can find my contact there in the Northern New England page. Many browsers will, if you have location services, will point you toward our chapter. And please feel free to reach out, call, or email. We'll be glad to help.
All right. Karen Hammer-Williamson is the Vermont Care Services Coordinator for the ALS Association, Northern New England chapter. And again, to learn more, ALS.org. Karen, I appreciate you being on the show this morning. Thanks very much.
Thanks for covering this important topic, Rick. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we're going to take a break for CBS News Update. Then we'll return to discuss how ARPA funds might be used to address housing in Vermont. And coming up today at 1, we've got the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. That's followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with Gallopin' Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. Friday marks a year since the American Rescue Plan Act was passed. So over the next few days, we'll be checking in with various members of Governor Phil Scott's cabinet to discuss what the administration is proposing on how those funds should be used to address various needs in the state. This morning, we're going to discuss housing with the Commissioner of the Department of Housing and Community Development, Josh Hanford. Josh, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, to ask Commissioner Hanford about the use of ARPA funds for housing or to share your thoughts, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. As I mentioned, Josh, I will be speaking to several members of the administration about the budgeting of ARPA funds over the next few days, but you're batting leadoff, so I'm going to go over some of the global questions first. What amount is coming to Vermont because of this federal bill?
Sure. The total coming to the state is about $1.25 billion. And that came in two chunks. It's pretty much all available to the state at this point. And that's in addition to the local funds that every municipality in the state received. And so the American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA, it's also referred to as the state and local fiscal recovery funds, was an effort to sort of bring us out of this pandemic and to recover and allowed a broad use for these funds, which includes housing and infrastructure, broadband, and all sorts of other ways to address the results of the pandemic.
You said
and housing, of course, it's one of the lead priorities, one of the largest needs in Vermont. And so the governor put a request for $250 million of the ARPA funds to go towards creating, building housing, which was above and beyond the annual funding for affordable housing development in Vermont.
Mm-hmm. And you said, broad use of the funds. Are there specific uses designated for any of the allocation, any of the $1.25
billion by the feds? Well, that was really left up to the state to decide what their greatest needs were. You know, of course, there's rules that come with these funds from the federal government, you know, that it must directly result to the effects of the pandemic. We know in the housing space that we have seen our housing challenges grow substantially as a result of the pandemic. And, you know, the governor put a bold, request for funding to address the various housing needs we have across the state.
And Josh, in addition to housing, and I promise we'll get very specific on that in a moment, but in addition to housing, what are the other key areas that Governor Scott would like to see, where he'd like to see the money used?
Sure. Well, there was, infrastructure. We have some long-standing infrastructure needs across the state, be it water, sewer, connections and upgrades, connectivity, broadband, telecom, climate change mitigation, and economic recovery. Those are the sort of five buckets of transformational sort of changes that the governor proposed to use these ARPA funds for, since this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to really reinvest in the needs of Vermont in a way that we haven't been able to do for decades. So housing, connectivity, climate change mitigation, and then water, sewer, stormwater infrastructure needs, and economic recovery.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, about 20%, $250 million, the governor would like to see be used for housing. So give us an overview of, first of all, what your department oversees, the Department of Housing and Community Development.
Sure. The Department of Community Development, it's in the Agency of Commerce and Community Development. Relatively small department. We're involved in everything from protecting our historic resources and our historic, walkable, vibrant downtowns and villages, planning, land use planning, community development, helping our communities address the needs that they have, and working on housing, bringing more housing to Vermonters at levels they need. So we have a pretty broad sort of scope with a fairly small, dedicated professional team that really works in partnership and collaboration with lots of other organizations and agencies to make this work happen.
All right. And Josh, even with the recent influx of people moving into Vermont, we have a population of less than 650,000. So don't we have enough housing stock for even that many people?
Well, it's no. We have a serious housing availability and affordability crisis, and the needs are not the same across the state. If you're in some of our growing counties like Chittenden County and maybe parts of Addison County and Franklin County, we need net new housing built. We need housing that serves the needs of the population now, which often is smaller family sizes. But in other parts of the states, we have existing housing stock that really is underutilized. It's offline. It's in poor condition. We have housing needs assessments that we do every 5 years to receive federal funding from the Department of Housing and Urban Development that have documented this need ongoing for decades. And it really shows that in some of our counties across the state, we have poor quality housing stock that needs a reinvestment. And so in those areas, bringing units that are offline, back online, reinvesting in that housing stock is the solution for those parts of the state. So it really depends on which region you are, what the housing solutions are. But we need to invest in our housing to really meet the needs of our population and really to really bring Vermont forward.
You bring up an interesting point, because I think a lot of times when we hear money for housing, we think of brand new housing. But you've talked about housing that's offline. So describe a property that might encompass, and how the state would get involved in bring that online and making it a very livable, usable residence for a Vermonter?
Sure, absolutely. You know, you just have to go down the road to Barry City, and the city of Barry is taking a very aggressive approach on this and trying to put some of their local ARPA money towards this purpose. But, you know, if you look at some of the neighborhoods, you see some homes that aren't occupied. They're vacant. They're, you know, run down. But yet we have a housing crisis. We have a shortage of housing. Those properties need a reinvestment. They need to be brought up to code. They need to be weatherized. They need to be safe and affordable for folks to live in. And so, you know, one of the approaches that the governor has used these ARPA funds for is a program called Vermont Housing Improvement Program that is a public-private partnership. We give a small incentive grant to the property owner to fix that unit up, make it energy efficient and nice and safe with a condition that they rent to someone at an affordable rate. And already through these tremendous federal resources, we've been able to bring back online 251 units of housing that was in this condition. It was dilapidated, you know, not currently used. By partnering with the owners to give them a small incentive, they match it with their own funds. And we, like I said, 251 units, half of those being available to folks that are exiting homelessness. So it's a really important strategy for serving the needs of some of Vermont's most vulnerable. And it's a quick, efficient, cost-effective way to meet our housing needs in many parts of the state by using what we have in our historic neighborhoods. It has a multiplier effect of, you know, bringing the property tax grand list values up, sort of, improving the whole neighborhood.
Right.
And so that is a big part of the governor's strategy. And we've had some success with putting money out for this program, but we have a lot more work to do. And, you know, the governor's asked for a lot more funding for this type of program, another $25 million. But we really need, you know, the legislative support to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. The $250 million, Josh, how many housing units do you think that would translate into? How many Vermonters would that house?
Right. So it depends on what we get for projects.
Sure.
What I can tell you is to date, we've already been able to build over 800 new housing units. Some of those are taking that existing stock that was offline and bringing it up to code. And some of those are absolutely brand new housing units. And there's another 800 currently in development. So the 800 we've already done is tripling what we normally do in Vermont in any given year. Mm. And so it's a massive improvement, in addressing our housing needs, but we still have much more to go. And depending on the costs of each of these projects, they vary. You know, these VHIP projects could be as little as $24,000 to bring a unit online. You know, building new sometimes could be $300,000 or $400,000. And so the mix of types of housing we're able to work on will depend on how many total units we bring online.
Mm-hmm.
But we know Vermont has a need of about 5,000 housing units short at this point. So we're going to do as many as we can with these funds and work with all our partners across the state to address all the housing needs we can with these funds. And we have, 4 years to do this. So, you know, we're only a year in and we've had this sort of success. We hope we can have more. But time is ticking and it's urgent. We need these funds to be available to address these housing needs now. The governor is focused like a laser on this. And we feel we could be moving a little faster than we are at this point.
Josh, Act 250 has been credited for keeping Vermont from allowing development to get too out of control in the state. But has it also prevented the state from adding the needed number of housing units? Josh, you with us? All right. Let's see if we can get Josh back on the line. I don't know if he took a break or – Josh, you still with us? All right. Danny, why don't you try to reconnect with Josh Hanford, and I'll let people know what's going on here. We are talking with Commissioner of Housing and Community Development, Josh Hanford, about the ARPA funds that the state has received. That is $1.25 billion, a large pot of money. And the governor's administration would like to parse that out in about five different buckets. And that includes housing. One fifth or 20% would be $250 million for housing. And we're discussing that with Josh Hanford, the Commissioner of Housing and Community Development. Let's see if we've got him back on the line. All right. Josh, you with us again?
I'm here. I don't know what happened. It went dark.
This happens. All right. So the question I brought up was Act 250, been credited for keeping Vermont from allowing development to get too out of control here in the state. But has it also prevented the state from adding the needed number of housing units?
I think in some cases it has done that. You know, what we look at it, when we look back decades, we can see that in the 80s, we were permitting and building between 3,000 and 5,000, permanent residents. These aren't second homes during that decade. And since then, we have dropped off to, you know, less than 1,000. We were really increasing our permanent rate of change in housing supply by about 2% during that decade, 1980 to 1990. And in the last decade, that has shrunk to 0.2%. Mm. So we haven't been meeting our housing demands here for decades. And some of what I hear from developers is, you know, it creates barriers, added costs, uncertainty, risk. Some folks don't like seeing housing going up in their neighborhood. So it can have an effect of slowing down or shrinking housing development. And we think that we've proposed some smart growth solutions where we all say we want housing in our downtowns, in our villages, places that already have infrastructure. And we really should be focusing our housing efforts to those locations and be removing any barriers that add cost or delay the process, because that's where we want the housing, and we know it's a better place for people to live.
Josh, Governor Scott has said he'd like to see middle-income housing stock be more robust, to be added. What does that mean, middle-income housing stock?
Sure. It's a hard term to define, but I think people know what it is in their gut. You know, folks that are average income earners in the state, and depending on where you are and your household size, you know, somewhere between 60,000, 70,000 and 120,000 household income that needs homes between 200,000 to 320,000, you know, somewhere in that range. It varies by county. But the bottom line is those homes are not being built in Vermont to any large degree, because the cost of construction, the cost of, you know, permitting, the cost of labor, land availability really drives up the costs of the homes, the actual construction costs. And so we need to put some incentives on the table, which we have, to help bring down those development costs, to ensure more of these modest homes, you know, starter homes, can be built in Vermont to really help our, you know, working families become homeowners. And the governor's proposed $15 million of this ARPA funding to go towards that effort. You know, the majority of the ARPA funds for housing has really been to address, you know, the lower income, most vulnerable, you know, address folks that are still homeless. But we need to work on this missing middle housing gap as well. And, you know, the governor's put forward ideas, and we hope that they can be supported by the legislature here this session soon.
Now, we've talked about, you know, the middle income. There's also affordable housing. Any of the money that you'd like to direct from the ARPA funds for housing, would any of it be allocated for housing for homeless Vermonters?
Yes. A number of the housing units we've brought online have been serving that need. The first 60 to 70 million of ARPA money that's been spent towards building housing, at least half of it has served folks exiting homelessness. and that continues to be a priority. I mean, really, I think what the governor is proposing here is a comprehensive, you know, really four-part plan recipe for our housing situation, which is smart growth, permit, land use, and zoning reform to allow more housing to be built where we want it, where we have infrastructure. It's to reinvest and revitalize in our current housing stock, where those opportunities exist, and support our historic neighborhoods and provide affordable housing for those that need it in our communities, and also assist the families that fall into this middle income that can't find a place to call home in Vermont, and then to continue to support our most vulnerable Vermonters that need supportive housing, that need housing to come out of homelessness or recovery from substance abuse disorder. It's really all four of those ingredients that get us the housing solutions we need in Vermont and really help us move forward and recover from this pandemic.
For this to be reality, it has to be approved by the legislature. So, and it's been proposed by Governor Scott to the legislature. What have you heard so far from the State House?
Well, last year we had some success in getting a large chunk of this, about 75 to 80 million, depending on where you look at the sources, to support affordable housing development. Much of that going to address folks exiting homelessness. But we right now, this session, are really in the middle of fighting for that housing for the missing middle, to actually encourage the building of new modest homes where we need them in Vermont, and to, you know, purchase and rehab some of these homes that are offline to provide, you know, middle income families with a place to call home. You know, we want Vermont to grow. We see folks coming here for, you know, the safety that we all had during the pandemic, the lifestyle that we live, but we can't do that if we don't have a place for people to live. We can't address our workforce challenges if we can't provide homes for the folks coming here to take all the jobs that are available. And so we really need the support of the legislature to move these proposals forward and do it quickly. I don't think we need to wait until summer, until after the session, to let some of this money move. We have developers out there that are waiting on the sidelines to build more housing. And if we could get approval of these, releasing these funds, you know, now, we could be starting more housing projects.
Josh Hanford is the commissioner of the Department of Housing and Community Development. Commissioner Hanford, thank you so much for being on with us this morning.
You're welcome.
All right.
Thank you for having us. And, yeah, have a great day.
All right, you too. We're going to take a break for the top of the hour news. Then we'll be back to talk with Brent Curtis, and he is getting warmed up for a basketball doubleheader tonight of tournament action from the Berry Auditorium. First, he'll have boys Division IV semifinals. That's White River Valley against Long Trail Mountain. And then a D2 semifinal grudge match, Spalding versus Montpelier. And that follows the Brady Farkas show. So Brady will be on from 5:30 to 6:15 tonight with the Brady Farkas show. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds, from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint, and we've called our man off the bench this morning. This was going to be open phones, but we've got a replacement. After watching so many high school hoopsters through the years come in late in the game and rally their team, we have basketball play-by-play man Brent Curtis doing the same now. I'm sure he had a nice, quiet morning plan prepping for tonight's high school tournament doubleheader, but he's been pressed into action this morning to get us ready for the high school hoops that we've got for you for the rest of the week into the weekend. And at the same time, we're going to hear about the career of this WDEV All-Star, Brent Curtis. So, Brent, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Rick, thank you so very much. I have to tell you right from the top, full disclosure, I'm a big fan.
Thank you. And I love what you do. So this is going to be Fanboy Central here for the next half hour. And listeners, if you'd like to chat with Brent, give him a bada bing. You can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Brent, when did you start doing high school basketball play-by-play on WDEV?
Well, you know, I was asked that just the other night, and I think I'm going back maybe 15 years, 16 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I might be a skunch over that. I might be pushing 17. So, and I started at WLVB. Mm-hmm. I was their first full-time basketball announcer at our sister station, and that's where I started over in Lamoille and pretty much into Caledonia.
Do you remember the first game that you called?
Oh, my God, do I ever. I had done an audition tape for Mr. Squire and had gone through all the basics, and then they just sort of put me out there because I'd had college experience, but that, of course, was a couple of decades prior. And I was at People's Academy, and it was something that I had never experienced before because People's Academy is not regulation size, but they have fans. Let me tell you, Rick, they have fans, and the gym was packed, and I was using a 3x5 card system that as the players would go up and down the court, I would already have their name, basic information, height, et cetera, et cetera. And it's all laid out, and then I can switch to 3x5 card because that's what I did in college.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't work at People's Academy because 72 people bumped into my table before the end of the first quarter, and my cards were everywhere. So I was kind of scrambling a little bit. But what was happening was this very nice couple next to me, older couple, probably my age now, and he would get up and he would just lip off some profanity at the officials. You GD this, get your head in the GD game. And so I go into commercial at the end of the first quarter, and I almost think it was Craig Ladd. He said, Brent, you've got to tell that guy to back down because the FCC is going to really nail us.
Oh, my gosh.
So I leaned over and I said, folks, please, I don't want to interfere with your night. I want you to have a wonderful time. But I said, your swearing goes over the air, and we're going to be penalized for it. And this nice, nice lady, who's his wife, leans over and she goes, Harold, no more. None. No. Stop. You get into the second quarter, and I'm partway through, and Harold rips one out. You, GD, no account, something. And she leans over, and I'm sitting, they're no more than 3 feet away from me, probably 2 feet. She said, GD, Harold, and then she drops the F-bomb. Don't do that again. Can't you tell that he's going to get in trouble? From that moment on, Peoples was one of my favorite places to go.
Oh, and we're still on the air, so the FCC didn't get too riled by it. But what a great start.
It is a true story, and they were the nicest, nicest people. And she looked at me and put her hand over her mouth and went, oops, and went on with the call. And it was a great experience, and it's one that I look forward to every year. Peoples had a good year a couple of years later, and they, for the first time, piped our games in. They videotaped it into the cafeteria and then turned the radio on.
Oh, wow.
So that was sort of the beginning of what was to happen in the future. But, again, Peoples Academy, great place to be, and wonderful relationships there.
I love it. You mentioned you did it in college. Where was that?
I was at Ottawa University in Ottawa, Kansas.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of a special place, and kind of tried out for it. I worked in college radio throughout my time there.
Mm-hmm.
But the big special story I'd like to share with you is that my professor, my broadcast journalism professor, was also an adjunct at Kansas University, which is just a few miles down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And the big treat was every year that one of the announcers got to do something special. You might go to the cow auction or the cattle auction, or you might go to the train show. In the year that we went to KU to see the Jayhawks play Kansas State, so it's KU, K-State,
wow.
I got to broadcast the game. Now, this is in the 74.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I come from Montpelier, Vermont, population 5,000. I walk into the Fogg Gymnasium in Allen Fieldhouse at 18,700 people.
Yeah.
Now, I know that's not all the people listening, but here I am probably one of the most exciting things that I did in broadcasting. It was great fun, and I actually got to do it 2 years in a row.
Fogg Field House could have been moved to Vermont and become the second largest city in the state that night.
Think about that for just 1 second. Oh. And the kindness that these people showed me. These were national broadcasters, of course. Yeah. And this is kind of before ESPN had kind of taken over. So we had tons of radio and just a few television stations. The kindness they extended to me, just making me feel at home and checking with me. And it was wonderful. It was incredible. And what an experience. What a great game to call. My gosh.
Oh, man. Brent, approximately how many high school basketball games do you think you've done for Radio Vermont?
Oh, Lord. In the beginning, I think I did 15 a year, but that changed after about the second year, third year. I average a minimum of 31. And then whatever I do in the postseason and whatever I do for WLVB is that. So usually, I think I'm right around 55 games a year.
Wow.
Probably more some years.
Oh, my gosh. So you must be nearing at least 1,000 games that you've called for us.
Good question. I might be. Yeah. I just don't know.
Yeah.
I just take them one at a time and and as I said to you before, the relationships that we've developed over the years, I look forward to going to Randolph. I love going to Hyde Park. And these are friends now. These folks, these educators and people are just great.
That's fantastic. Let's go to Cabot and take a call from Michael. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Good.
So I was curious. One, you guys are all great characters, and you're all quite inspiring on you know, Saturday morning on the Trading Post and the Dunk Show, all that good stuff. But I was curious what the background is and asking what people had for breakfast is.
Michael, that is a perfect question. And by the way, my boss asked me the same question. When I first started doing that, asking about it was when people were having a hard time talking. They were kind of hesitant and they stuttered. And I would, in the beginning, I would just kind of break in and say, "Hey, what'd you have for breakfast?" Mm. And they'd stop and they'd think and they'd tell me. And then they go on and just go on with the items they wanted to buy, sell, swap, or trade.
Yep.
And pretty soon people kind of caught on to that. And I would ask it in the beginning, or I would maybe ask at the end, or people would volunteer it. And it has been such a fun thing, Michael. People, and I did it just in the beginning just to, you know, loosen people up.
Right. Yeah. Any breakfast items that you've really thought, oh man, I want to leave, go have breakfast with Bill from Moortown?
Oh man, oh man, oh man. You know, I'll hit a good one every once in a while. Sometimes it's Corinth or it's Wolcott, and you know, I'll get scrambled eggs, Texas toast, bacon, home fries, and coffee. Oh, that's, you know, that's a pretty good breakfast. And then I had the guy that called in just about 2 months ago, and he said, you know, I'm taking my medication, and I'm going to have a couple of beers.
Uh-oh.
And I said, okay, thanks a lot. No problem. But they're all great. They see, if you'll allow me, they're like country breakfast.
Yeah.
And I have lovely Peg call me from the barn, and she had rolled oats and a nice cup of tea. And, oh, by the way, Peg called last week, and it's because her mother heard that I was having some throat problems. She said, you know, he's getting a scratchy throat from all those basketball games, and she gave me directions on what I should do for my throat during basketball season. Very, very nice.
I love it. Well, if you got the double dip tonight, and we're going to talk about that after the break, but if by, you know, early in the second game, you're having trouble with the bada bing, Charlotte Strasser gave us a rousing bada bing this morning on the party calendar. So she can always jump in. You might want her to come and sit next to you and let her give a few of those late in the game if your voice gets a little scratchy. All right.
That girl can do anything.
That's true. Let's take a call from Craig in Bristol. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Rick. Good morning. I just wanted to pass on that Brent almost got a Ben and Jerry's flavor. Whoa.
Yeah, back on January 31st, 2018, they put out a list of funniest flavor suggestions that they never made, unfortunately. And number 19 is Dad Bada Bing. It would have been vanilla ice cream with chocolate-covered Bing cherries and a marshmallow swirl. But Brent would have got his Bada Bing in there, so I'm sorry.
Oh, Brent, oh, so close to nationwide.
So close. And by the way, you should know that's my favorite flavor.
Uh-huh. Well, that was number 19. So anyway, you almost made it, Brent.
Oh, I love it.
Thank you. Yeah, it was great.
Thanks, right. Craig. That's a great call. Okay, so tonight, Brent, you got this double dip. So give us a preview, first of all, of the Division IV semifinal.
Okay. Before I do that, let me just set the stage.
Okay.
The Berry Auditorium seats about 1,800 people. It was built in 1939. Sports Illustrated called it one of the top five places to watch a high school basketball game in the country. And with that said, when you get to the Berry Odd, it is magic. This week, Division IV was turned on its head when number one seed Rivendell lost to Blue Mountain. Rivendell is actually in Orford, New Hampshire. Blue Mountain's down in Wells River. And it was a huge upset. The Blue Mountain boys came back and won the game by 1 point. They didn't score a basket entire first quarter. The place was going absolutely bananas. How much fun is that?
Wow.
So now Blue Mountain makes it to the finals on Saturday at high noon. And tonight, our first game is the number two seed Long Trail Mountain Men from Dorset, Vermont, taking on White River Valley. And so they're the number three team. That'll be the first game. And I'll tell you, that's going to be a fun game. But Long Trail looks to be very good. They're tall in the front court. But after what happened there Monday night with Rivendell, no comment. Oh, but before I go, let me tell you what the coach said about it. Listen to this. The coach from Rivendell after the game, of course he felt bad, but he said to the reporter, you know, we've done so well all year long. We've done it all year long. And then suddenly we get here, we can't execute. You know, funny things happen in this building.
Yeah.
This is a perfect example. So, you know, that's the coach talking. So that's our first game, and it should be a good game. We're looking forward to it. Again, we're surprised that Rivendell's not going to be there, but it'll be fun to see the Mountain Men coming in from Long Trail.
Well, you know, it is something we should remind ourselves and everyone about. You know, these are high school students, high school athletes.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one thing to play, you know, at your home gym and, you know, play during the regular season. But as you said, you get in that little pressure cooker there at the Odd. And, you know, you still have homework to do, man. And, you know, it's like you got a test tomorrow. Yeah.
I think they suspend homework for this 2 weeks.
Oh, do that.
You know, when I first I didn't miss a game for 35 years. And that doesn't even put me in the top category, but I love to be there early when the small teams come in because they do this Hoosiers thing. They take them on the court and they say, now look at this. And some even measured the basket, if you remember that scene from Hoosiers.
Yeah.
And I've talked to coaches over the years that play loud music in the gym. I've seen coaches use color cards to call the play because you can't hear it on the court.
Right.
You can't hear it with 2,000 people yelling.
Mm.
So it's an interesting place. And, you know, we're talking about Wells River. We're talking about Orford, New Hampshire.
Yeah.
Come on, Proctor, Pollock.
Yeah.
The entire town's there, Rick.
Oh,
I mean, they close it up.
How beautiful. All right, let's get to Cabot again and talk to Lewis, who's next on the line. Hi, Lewis.
Good morning.
Morning.
How are you doing, Brent?
I'm good, Lewis. How are you?
Pretty good. The only way I get to talk with you is call you on the radio. Anyway, who are you picking up in Montpelier and Barry? Because you are
boy.
Montpelier, right?
Oh.
You can't do that to me. As you know, I graduated from Montpelier High School, three-sport guy there, but I worked for the city of Barrie, police officer for 25 years.
boy.
I guess I'll always be a Solon. How's that?
Yeah, you know, I hesitated asking you to pick any winners today because I don't want to put you on the spot. I know it could put you in a tough position with the fans when you walk in there. But let's talk about this rivalry, Spalding and Montpelier. You already have, like you said, the odd being a pressure cooker. What is it like when you have a massive rivalry game like this, Brent?
When you're on the other end, when you're back at the studio running the board, we have to work very hard because I don't need a crowd mic. Mm-hmm. The sound is it's magnificent. It's electrifying. If you ask any player, any coach that's been down on the main floor, what it's like, and they'll just say electric. Mm. It's loud, and it's fun. And parents are on one side, students are on the other. The parents are dressed up even better than the students. You know, we had a whole bunch of hula people over on the other side this year, and it was great fun. And now, of course, the in thing in college is to have somebody's face on a post, and so we got all these faces around there. And you know, this Montpelier Spalding thing goes back. I went all the way back into the 30s when they played, and I think Montpelier won by a score of 21-19. Mm. And but Spalding rivalry with Montpelier is it just goes on. I have a mimeographed letter from my football coach in 1971 that said, don't go to Barry this weekend. There is a lot of tension between these two schools, so please stay around Montpelier.
Wow. Oh, my.
And I have lots of friends in Barry, and it is a great rivalry to have. It's not as big as it was, but believe me, tonight we'll get it.
I love it. Let's head to the land of the floating bridge. We got Katie in Brookfield. Hi, Katie.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to, I heard Brent mention coming to Randolph. My son is a sophomore and plays for the Randolph team. Earlier this year, Randolph hosted Williamstown, which is another big rivalry in Division II. And mm-hmm. we were there at the game watching the teams warm up. And I had my phone pressed to my ear, and another mom had her phone pressed to her ear. A mom across the gym reached out to us and said, is something going on? I see you ladies over there with your phones to your ear. And we said, no, we're just both listening to Brent Curtis call the pregame show. So even though we were there live watching the game, we both wanted to hear Brent do his pregame show.
Oh, Katie, that's beautiful. Thanks so much for that. Brent,
that's so nice.
Isn't that great to hear?
It is. That's wow. Thank you so much.
So between Spalding and Montpelier, then, is somebody already waiting for them for the finals then?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're looking to see the game that's going to tell the story is going to be North Country is going to have they'll be playing, and they'll be in the North Country lost. I beg your pardon. They lost to MSJ, so Mount St. Joseph will be there at the that was the biggest upset of the year, you know.
Wow.
North Country, they lost their only game the week before the finals went in, but when they met MSJ, who was number 5 at the odd this week, mm-hmm. they had lost their big rebounder and shooter, and that really affected them against MSJ. So, yeah, MSJ, Mount St. Joseph, will be waiting for Montpelier at the odd or Spalding at the odd this weekend.
Mm. Now, are the kids still playing with masks on, or have they been able to run around without them now?
The athletes, all the people on the bench, which would include a trainer, statistician, the coaches, the officials, and as I mentioned, the players are now maskless.
Good.
And the rest is recommended to have the mask.
Yeah, I can't imagine what that must be like to have to play, especially big games, to be masked up. And kudos to the students for bearing that, you know, throughout this pandemic. Now, what's on tap the rest of the week, Brent, after tonight's big doubleheader?
Well, we'll have tonight's, and then we will go into Wednesday, and that's the fun one. This tonight will be high electric, high tension, and then Wednesday night, the game is going to be Hazen versus Williamstown. This is Division III. Here's another rivalry. Now, Hazen's oldest rivalry goes back with People's Academy, when Hazen used to be Hardwick Academy. I think they go back about 100 years.
Wow.
But recently, in the last couple of decades, Hazen versus Williamstown has been the game at the odd. And so they're right back at it this year. And this will be another big house. I don't know where the, you know, Williamstown only has 1,100 people. So you got to figure when you get into the odd, they're probably bringing in their relatives. So Williamstown will be there ranked third. Hazen will be there ranked second. They split during the regular season. And they, by the way, these are two tremendous coaches. I can't say enough good stuff about them. Aaron Hill for Hazen and that incredible program there. And, of course, Jack Carrier, who announced this year it would be his final year. Mm. Now, in 13 years, Jack Carrier has been to the odd 10 times with 6 championships and with 4 runners-up. And some of those runners-up have been, well, to Hazen, and then Hazen has been a runner-up for a few years. And they're two great programs with a huge fan base. Now, when I say huge, I don't have to talk about Burlington or Rutland. I'm just talking about Hazen, which is the, you know, the area there, Hardwick, Greensboro, you know, go out around there. And Williamstown, well, Williamstown's just Williamstown.
Wow, Billtown. Oh,
yeah.
How about
but
that?
Both coaches have had so many awards that it's amazing. But boy, it's order and it's discipline that gets them there every year.
Love that. Brent Curtis is WDEV's All Star on and off the court. And Brent, I want to thank you so much for being on with us this morning.
It is a pleasure, and I really enjoy chatting with you. And thanks to everyone who called in, and thanks to all of our listeners.
Yeah, great. Rest that voice now for the rest of the day. Do not yell at anybody.
You're the only person I'm talking to all day, okay?
All right, shut it down. Good man. All right, we're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll be back to enjoy a quaff at Essex County's first microbrewery. And coming up today at 11, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. There was a time when we had thousands of local breweries in this country. You could find many wonderful, distinctive quaffs just about anywhere you traveled. Then the major labels took over and we lost most of those wonderful local breweries. But the tide has turned again, and it's not hard to find a microbrewery near where you live. But it did take Essex County in the Northeast Kingdom a little longer than most of the rest of the state to get there. But thanks to the owners of Dirt Church Brewing, that has been rectified. Joining me now to discuss how it was done are the owners of Dirt Church Brewing. We have Anna Cronin. Anna, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. And Bruce Lindsay. Bruce, great to have you here as well.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning.
And listeners, if you've got a question for Bruce or Anna about the beer, or if you've had the pleasure of worshiping at the Dirt Church, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Bruce, you were a home brewer, so when and what got you into home brewing?
Just sort of a need to fulfill some fun hobby that is also part of the beer culture. Just let me have some fun cooking in the kitchen, if you will, and, uh-huh. and see the process of beer from, you know, the beginnings to the end. And it just kind of became a real draw to, and just was captivated by the process.
And then at what point did you know that, hey, I'm good enough to take this to the next level and open up a microbrewery?
My partner, Anna Cronin, said, "Hey, your beer is really good." And I was a bit modest about it and said, "I know, it's good, but I don't know about the open market." And we started brewing together, and I have a friend back in Connecticut, where I'm from, where we were brewing a lot. we had about 50 recipes, and we started sort of going through that and really feeling that they were good and ready for market when we decided to do so.
Well done. And Anna, well done for pushing Bruce in that direction. Like he said, from Connecticut, so how and why did you choose East Haven, Vermont as a place to launch the beer brand?
Well, one of the things that was always so wonderful about the Northeast Kingdom is both Bruce and I had been recreating up here for over a decade, independently of one another. So I grew up ski racing, and he had a former family member with a summer cabin. And so we both were enjoying the fruits of this area for years and years. And we actually met each other while riding a mountain bike race called Circumberg, which was, a 26-mile mountain bike race around the mountain of Burke, goes through Victory Hill and comes around through Vermont State Forest land and comes back into Burke. So this place has a really special meaning for us personally because it's where we met.
Yeah.
But we also love the area because of the years that we've spent here enjoying the snow and the lakes and the summer and the fall and all of the things.
Now, Anna, I got to say, the only thing more interesting than a home brewer has got to be a ski racer. So tell us a little bit about your ski racing career.
Oh, gosh. Just young and in school. And I had a bad crash when I was a teenager. So that sort of ended my hopes and dreams of taking ski racing to the next level. So but that's where I became familiar with the Vermont ski scene. And really enjoyed Burke Mountain in particular, just because it was really rustic, and it's a little bit farther off the beaten path.
Yep.
So that was always one of my favorite ski mountains to visit, and it really spoke to both of us because of those values.
Bruce, you had quite a bit of work to do to get Dirt Church up and running. The property had, I think, a church and a Grange Hall. Am I correct about that?
Yep, that's accurate.
And then what happened to the Grange Hall?
Well, the Grange Hall was modified into a pretty messy two-family house, and the foundation was collapsing. Our initial thought was to try to save it, but it was so modified that it wasn't really the former Grange Hall. Mm. It was something else. So we ended up taking it down mostly for safety and not to spend too much time fixing the crookedness of it. It made more sense to start over straight lines and plumb and level walls and foundations. And we kept the footprint small. And with the help of the town of East Haven's historical library, they were able to show us some photos of the Grange from the 30s and 40s. And we were able to take those photographs and sort of piece together what we thought was the best representation of the former East Haven Grange Hall. We ended up with about a 20 by 30, just a post and beam style building with a little loft space upstairs. And that's our main tap room. And that's a really lovely building. It's warm and cozy. All the knotty pine is in it. It's rough sawn. It's got all the character that we wanted to reflect sort of the vernacular of the Vermont barn and a warm space that you would want to come in, have a beer, and just put your feet up, relax, and tell stories.
Wow.
Later, about 6 months later, we built the back brewery, which is our manufacturing space, which is conventionally framed on a nice slab, and it's got a 7-barrel brew house and all the keg washing equipment, and we do canning there with a portable company, and that's sort of the factory, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it fits the space that we have, and it lends nicely to the church next door in terms of the space and the shapes of the roof lines and the peaks and the ridges.
Nice. And Anna, how is the church being used now?
Well, when Bruce and I first started thinking about what to do with it, we kind of went through the whole litany of what are we going to do with it? Or it would make such a cute coffee shop or an Airbnb or a brewery. Ha ha ha. But ultimately the church is a seasonal space, so there was no heat system, there was no running water. It's basically a barn that happens to have a bell in it. So I didn't want to change the integrity of this structure by adding on all of the things that we would need in order to make any of those sort of entrepreneurial ideas come to life.
Mm-hmm.
So it really felt more appropriate to restore it exactly the way that it is. So this church was built in 1876. So it had been a community space for religious purposes for about 150 years. So it only made really sense to us, and me in particular, that it should remain so, if not for religious service, but at least a space for community to come and gather. So I repaired the plaster and lath, gave it a new, fresh coat of paint on the interior, and spruced it up, and it has all the original pews, and I reached out to all the local artists in the area, which I had no idea how incredibly talented the kingdom is.
Wow.
And how many artists live here. It's fantastic. So I had more artwork than I knew what to do with for the summer.
That's
and put it up in a gallery
problem.
Style.
Oh, I love it.
It was, yeah.
Well, so Anna, Anna,
open in
The church does help give the brewery a name, but, you know, Dirt Church Brewing, explain where that name came from.
Well, Dirt Church was this sort of cheeky little nickname that we would call our Sunday morning rides, either on mountain bikes or on gravel bikes. And it became our tradition and our, you know, meeting space for our community.
Mm-hmm.
So what we are trying to do is educate the public that Dirt Church isn't just for cycling, and it isn't just for, you know, a small group of people, but it's really a term that encompasses this lifestyle or this ethos of, you know, we meet our group of people and we do our activity that really, enjoys the outdoor space and recreation. So it could be, you know, hiking, it could be bird watching, it could be extreme underwater basket weaving. I don't know.
Can't wait till you do that. Bruce, East Haven is not a very big town. So do you get enough local traffic to make the tasting room a lively place?
Yeah. No, we have a great location on Route 114. So we're halfway between Burke and Island Pond. East Haven is a residency of 293 people and about 37 square miles. So we knew East Haven wasn't going to be the backbone of our business model. It more relies on the mountain, the Kingdom Trails network, the people who own camps, the ice fishers, big-time snowmobilers, all the hiking that's great around Lake Willoughby, the backcountry skiers. There's just an endless supply of people with camps and cabins and hunting and recreation and everything. And also, we had enough metrics looking around the area to support an idea that, you know, our business is also brought in by Canadians. 50% of the business in the Northeast Kingdom is Canadian influence. When Anna and I launched this Dirt Church Brewing Company, we were preparing for a post-COVID world where we had a relative back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
We would have Canadians here enjoying our recreation just as much as the visitors to the kingdom from domestic parts of New England. So we really, we're still waiting for that green light to happen. We thought it might have happened a little bit sooner. But everybody's being cautious, and that's great, as we have been also. But we knew the area really needed something different, a place to go to. And our biggest question is, how often are we open? And, you know, given where we are and our proximity to things, and we always say we're open pretty much every day because we're always manufacturing beer. So if the light is on, you come in, we're going to probably serve you a beer no matter what time of day you show up. So it's a comfortable place, and, it needed it, and we were happy to provide.
Oh, I love it. The place you two would have gone to when you were recreating in the Northeast Kingdom all those years ago before you started this. I love it. And, Bruce, people are probably yelling at their radios. You've talked about everything but the beer so far. So it's time to talk about some of your beers. Tell us first about the Full Vermonti.
Well, I can't take full credit for the name, but it's a fun beer that Anna and I designed to embrace the agrarian virtues of Vermont. So the beer has all Vermont grains, all Vermont hops. It has our water and our staff putting the beer together. So we didn't bring any outside sources for the product, for the ingredients for that beer.
It's going to be a rotating series. We're going to do it pretty much quarterly. It'll always be called the Full Vermonti. It'll be like a pilot beer. The most recent one we did was a low ABV, like a pale malt. They called it a rye IPA. It's a blend of rye, wheat, and pale malt, and it gives the beer a nice smooth body, a light color. And then we used Champlain Valley hops out of Starksboro. They're Magnum and Nugget and a little bit of Chinook to give it just a little bit of bitterness and a little bit of some tropical lightness. It's a bright, fun beer. We have a lot of fun marketing it. Anna is very social media friendly.
I've seen the photo.
Chances are you've already lifted that sort of that doorway to understand what we're doing out here. So
I do.
That's one of the good ones. So thank you.
And Anna, how about one I'm dying to try? Tell me about India Black Ale.
Oh yeah, so Black IPA is kind of this wonderful sort of misnomer in the brewing world. So it's a dark beer base, but brewed in the same format as an IPA. It's also known as a Cascadian dark ale. So it looks like it would be a porter or a stout of some kind. It's really dark, really thick, and it tastes like an IPA. Mm. So these are kinds of brews that we like to, you know, kind of educate our people around us. A lot of people have never heard of a black IPA. A lot of folks have never heard of other brews that recipes that I've created, like a Brut IPA, which is an IPA brewed with champagne yeast. And we love kind of exploring new things and just giving it a try.
I love it. Bruce, we did hear some barking in the background. I understand there's some brewery dogs there at Dirt Church.
We have three brew dogs. We have a one-year-old yellow lab. She's the most vocal one here, and we're playing tennis ball with her to keep her quiet while we're on the mic here.
That's all right.
That's our new acquisition. Anna brought along with her a 7-year-old red lab thoroughbred. He's a beautiful dog, and he just loves to chase balls as well, but he's a little quieter. And then I have a grumpy 9-year-old rescue hound from Texas who doesn't like Vermont winters very well. She's adapted to sunbeams and the patient alpha dog who barks at people when they enter our brewery.
I love it.
The trifecta experience when you visit our brewery is always about the dogs. So
I love it.
Never a dull moment.
All right. So, Bruce, I'm going to give you a chance now to pick a beer you'd like to introduce me to. And then, Anna, you get the next round.
Sure. Well, I'm going to discuss Rejoice because it's named after my late mother. Mm-hmm. It gave us the foundation to do everything that we have done here at Dirt Church. It's a beer I had made right before my mother's passing about 2 years ago. And it's a nice IPA. It's about 6.5%. It's a little tropical. It's a hazy New England style beer. It's got Galaxy, Amarillo, and Citra in it. It's a nice, easy drinking beer, but it's truly an homage to my mother. And everything that was part of my childhood home was an inheritance of mine, which helped us leapfrog to make this church possible, the Grange Hall possible, and building a brewery and bringing our story to the kingdom. So it's with my pleasure to say that Rejoice is one of our flagship IPAs, and it's important and near and dear to my heart for the soul of our business.
That is absolutely beautiful. Anna, what would you like to have me try?
I would say one of the best surprise beers that we've had really surprise us in terms of its popularity is a double New England IPA style that I wanted to brew a recipe that wasn't bitter. My personal palate is I do like a bold IPA, but I really don't like that extra bittering that seems to be added.
Yep.
So I created a beer that was called Queen of Essex County. And it was my beer. It was my style. It was something that I wanted to brew because I enjoyed it. And so it is a 7.5% double IPA brewed with cashmere hops, which is one of my favorite flavors. And it's bold, it's smooth, it's not bitter, it's low IBUs, and it's naturally hazy. We didn't use any oatmeal in it. So it's a true traditional style of New England haze. And it has just absolutely blown us away with its popularity. So I think that it really shows that, you know, wherever you are, you can, you know, king of your own kingdom, so to speak, or queen in this case.
With the queen of Essex County. That is so great. And, Bruce, tell us a little bit about some of the events, because that's been a really neat part of what's going on at Dirt Church, some of the events that you've been holding there.
Oh, sure. We've had some great local music come in. In the summer months, we have an outdoor beer garden space. You can sit out back. We throw open the big barn doors from the brew house side of the building, and we have a great guy. Shrimp Tunes plays a lot. He's a one-man band.
He Shrimp!
Plays about four instruments simultaneously. He's a legend in the kingdom. We have some great trio of string instruments. The Bald Mountain Boys, they're out of Burke here. They're fantastic. They'll be here on St. Patrick's Day next week playing a lot of old Irish jig music and stuff. We've had bagpipers. We're going to have open mic Friday. A friend of mine's coming up. My old brew partner, matter of fact, is coming up, and he's going to play maybe a dozen acoustic songs. And we're booking a lot of stuff heading into April. We're hosting Rasta Pizza Gravel Race on April 30th. It's going to have bikers, about 2,000 of them. We're going to go right through our brewery and down the ramp. And if they want to, grab a beer on the way out the door.
Wow.
We're endlessly looking for new bookings. You know, having that musical experience while you have your feet in the grass at the brewery in the summer and the kingdom is nothing better than just having a beer and just relaxing in our space. So we're always looking for new talent. And we're happy to host almost 7 days a week going into the summer.
That's excellent. Anna, I do have to ask you, your name is Anna Cronin. And there are two now brewers in Vermont named Cronin, Jesse Cronin of Lucy and Howe over in Jericho. Any relation, or is that just happenstance that the Cronins are taking over the beer business?
Oh, well, you know, the Cronins are where it's at, right? No. I actually met Jesse for the first time over at the Nordic Farms Malt House a year and a half ago. We were doing a sensory seminar and realized that our last names were Cronin. There is no relation.
All right.
But we are realizing what a community the brewing world really is. And so at that meeting, we were still a brewery in planning. We were just building our space. We hadn't purchased our tanks yet. We were all perturbed and up in arms about what we were going to do and what the next plan of action was going to be. And so actually, Jesse was incredibly influential in helping us get our act together. And I don't know if he knows that, but I hope he's listening. He helped us bring it to the next level there and gave us the confidence that just go for it. So
well done. Cronin helping Cronin. All right. That is Anna Cronin, Bruce Lindsay, owners of Dirt Church Brewing in East Haven. You can check them out at dirtchurchvt.wordpress.com. Thank you both so much for being on. Give our best to the dogs.
We'll do. Cheers.
Thank you so much.
Cheers. All right, that's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we talk solar, we talk Ukraine, and we meet another Vermont Sports Hall of Fame inductee.